Hello and welcome to Androids and Assets. I'm Marshall.
And I'm Steven.
This is the podcast where we discuss the political economy of science fiction and fantasy. So that's really a discussion of, power structures, how decisions are made, conflicts are resolved. And we do that in the context of the science fiction and fantasy worlds that you love and love to hate.
Yeah, so today we have a very special guest with us. We have Lewis Evans, who is a writer recently returned to his native New York City from a half decade spent in the San Francisco Bay Area. His work has been published in Analog, SF, and F, Escape Pod, The Toast.
He's a two-time winner of both Zach Wiener-Smith's Bad Ad Hoc Hypothesis Festival and the Shipwreck Bad Erotic Fan Fiction Competition. He's the founding co-producer of Clitterary Salon, a feminist and queer literary show in the San Francisco Bay. Well, welcome to the show, Lewis.
Thanks so much. It's great to be on with the fabled Androids and Assets. I can only assume that one of you is named Androids, one of you is named Assets, and I look forward over the course of the show to figuring out which is which.
We get this a lot. I'm amazed.
But nobody's figured out which one is which.
Yeah, it's so amazing. That's the
good
part. To do a Twitter poll at some point. Okay, so today,
speaking of Androids and Assets, actually, I was not planning on starting and talk about this, but have you guys read Fondly Fahrenheit?
No.
Okay, Fondly Fahrenheit is this classic sci-fi story. I highly recommend it. Super weird. Cannot remember who wrote it. Might surreptitiously Google if you hear the keys going bang, 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 bang. But it is about a world where, because androids are so productive, there's exclusively a class of capitalists who are people who own at least one android, and a sort of less than the lumpen proletariat, who are people who own no androids. And the slavery analogy is not lost in the text. But the protagonist is this person who owns exactly one android, and it is broken in such a way that when it gets warm outside, the android does murders. And so he's like, I absolutely cannot relinquish the singular asset that separates me from total immiseration. But also, he doesn't know that, like, it's the temperature involved. He just knows that sometimes his android does murders. And so he's like, he's, because of this sort of capitalist logic of complicity, he's like immediately drawn into being this like unwilling cover-up guy, like getaway driver for his murderous asset, which is an android. Anyway, I can't believe it didn't occur to me until we started recording this. I highly recommend it to anyone who's listening. It is weird and very upsetting. So, that's everything you want out of
the climate change analogy is palpable.
Also there, yeah. I think it was a while ago. Like, I think it was before climate change was ubiquitous.
Almost certainly.
Yeah, it was crazy. Anyway.
Super. So we are excited to have Lewis here because he reached out to us on Twitter and was like, you guys sound amazing. And I can hardly contain myself. I want to be a part of this show.
That's verbatim.
We very magnanimously acquiesced and here he is.
And we're talking about your short story, Flash Crash. I think it's our primary. That's the primary text we've read and we're reviewing. And we thought, we opened it. I'm going to read the first line, and I like we heard it on Escape Pod, and it was like, oh, damn, we need to talk to this guy. Maisie, modified arbitrage intelligence for stocks and international equities, was an algorithm herself, a flash trading algorithm. She traded stocks, currencies, and futures with a latency of 6 microseconds. And a profit horizon of eternity. So we were like, oh man, we need to talk about this. Because that is a very in our wheelhouse opening sentence. I guess,
think it actually opens with Maisie was 6 years old on the day she woke up and died.
Yes.
It does get to the stocks real fast. Yeah. If you're
it's like
if you're
the
listening
third
to
sentence,
it, you're saying,
but
where
the
is the stock
sentence.
Market?
Right.
It's coming.
Okay. Yeah. We get to stock markets immediately and I'm like, oh God, okay, yeah, let's talk about this. So we are really trying to focus on more of the economics and kind of like what separates us from those things. So kind of what's your relationship to economics? Do you have like a training or a background in it or an interest in it?
So I have a surprisingly limited training in economics. I took exactly one class on it in college. The professor accused me of being a spy for the economics department. So the one class I took was, so I went to Harvard for undergrad, and the Harvard economics department, unsurprisingly, is a pretty straight and narrow sort of traditional microeconomic consensus kind of department, with the exception of one guy, Stephen Marglin, who they failed to force out. And so he's like their token communist, and he shows up at all their meeting, you know, department meetings, and causes trouble and mischief. He sort of comes from a, not exactly, communist isn't exactly accurate. He comes from sort of a different dissident economic tradition. And so he does have one class, which is the, an alternate approach to introductory economics, the premise of which is like everything that you wouldn't learn if you went to the standard intro economics courses. And as someone who sort of thinks of himself as perhaps fancier than he is, I was like, oh, I'll do the, you know, I'll do the hipster economics. I'll do whatever. And I was in that class, and Professor Marglin did accuse me of potentially being a spy for the economics department because of my familiarity with the sort of standard explanations as they were going up there. But I, you know, I was thinking about that a bit in the context of this podcast, and it's interesting. I don't think I've had a lot of formal training or even like major reading of large texts. I think a lot of what I know about economics and the state of the profession has sort of been absorbed by osmosis through the political conversation and through a lot of ambient stuff. You get a sense of these very well fleshed out, you know, sort of fictional universes, all the way down to like the deep, like biochemistry kind of things. You know, you have a sense that if you sat down with the author, you could say, what's the nitrogen cycle? Like, why are some plants blue? Like, why do they flower in the seasons that they flower? And then the economics is kind of a big question mark, right? It's one of those spaces that sometimes is underanalyzed. And I'm really interested in the question of economics. And I think in large part because, and you know, hopefully we'll get into this a little bit, my experience is that a lot of where economics, where that's sort of left as a question mark, is where we haven't answered questions about social arrangement more generally, right? It's not like, oh, you know, here are the hobbits, but like, what are their opinions on like, you know, banking derivatives? Like, I don't care about that. But economics, as we think of it, is like the conventional narrow line economics is a particular take on a much broader set of questions of social organization.
I think even like when they're not fleshed out, there's authors sometimes fall in the trap of just like falling back on the familiar. So it's like, oh, well, obviously this was funded by like a corporation and they're going to be making money off of this venture. That's why we're on this planet.
So I had a novel manuscript, and a couple of those in flight, and it's set in the 2400s, and there's sort of substantial technological changes to various life ways. And then I got to a bit in the story where I was like, okay, what would be a job that an ordinary person has? And, you know, a lot of the story takes place in the army, and then there it's sort of assumed, it's like, well, okay, the activities that you do are optimized for fighting wars, and they're assigned via this sort of command and control organization. But like, what would be a job that a regular person does in a world where you've put together technology that obviates a lot of the tasks that make up our everyday lives? You know, we're in a world where you have AI of any meaningful power, and where machine physical interfaces, you know, allow that AI to do labor. What does labor even look like? And a lot of people sort of, I think, absolutely retreat almost consciously into the familiar, right? And so I remember I was having a conversation on Twitter about this. You know, one of the things that's always a little funny is when you read, I think the example chosen was Asimov's Foundation texts, and it sort of assumed the existence of a stenographic pool, right? And it's like, haha, why would you have that? And I was thinking about that, and that's actually really interesting because this sort of touches on both the economics of labor and also the way that social assumptions get encrusted into that. Because on the one hand, stenographer is like a pretty narrow temporal job. And on the other hand, actually, scribes are really early. Scribe as a category is very long. And it's kind of weird that we live in a period in time where it seems like scribe is basically dead. And like stenography is really the last grasp of that, the last stage where there was a labor value of, where there was an expectation that there was a specialized task around recording words. But at the same time, like, okay, in the future, there are going to be scribes. That's not a bad guess, right? In the same way that if I say in the future, there are going to be pyramids or buildings, like that's not a bad guess. But you can often, when you try to write that, you don't just recreate the labor forces, but like the specific social milieu and assumptions that get baked into that. The fact that there are taxi driver jobs in the Fifth Element. And taxi driver jobs have been around for 400 years, right? It's like just based on the Berlin Wall math, the idea that there are taxi drivers in 2400 is super reasonable. It's like not a crazy guess at all. Now, things might happen that would obviate that, right? Like it might turn out that you invent self-driving cars and it might turn out that you don't, right? But the thing that probably won't continue is like the exact social structure in which that job is embedded. And so, yeah, it is definitely one of those things where a lot of people fall back both on big conceptual archetypes without asking, hey, just like, what is labor? What is capital? What is what are the social structures for motivation? And also one where it's easy to recapitulate the stereotypes that are available to the contemporary reader.
So in your manuscript, where did you land? What's their job? Are they stenographers?
I kind of buzzed by that. I wanted to give them an office job. So in this specific setting, there's powerful AI, but not like you see in, so in Flash Crash, spoiler for those of you reading along at home, listening along to this, go listen to Flash Crash first if you don't want to be spoiled before the sentence. But Flash Crash, the protagonist, the Flash trading algorithm, becomes both sentient and substantially omnipotent, I guess, the sort of hard takeoff AI scenario where a self-modifying, self-improving algorithm is able to achieve unbounded properties in a very short window of time. The problem that you have with that is unless you're really willing to go sort of the full Werner Vinge and commit to like, what are the robot gods doing as a meaningful chunk of your narrative, or as like a setting fact about your narrative, it can be hard to write in that sort of world. So the manuscript I was talking about, there are AIs that there's uploaded people, there are AIs, but nothing is really fully supplanted the human society. And sure. So I'm kind of leaned a little bit on the stereotype of, you know, what are our current post-industrial thought worker jobs like? And probably, you know, you're a marketing consultant or, you know, some sort of data management person who has a job that looks like, you know, a lot of these kind of conceptual middle management spaces.
I run 15 Twitter accounts for my job.
Well, right. You sit at some place where, I mean, it seems like a lot of the current, or when I say current, I mean like a lot of the new economic model is like there are a bunch of incredibly efficient artificial systems which aren't necessarily capable of tuning themselves to coordinate independently. And then there are a bunch of humans that need to interact with those systems. And so you have some job that looks like you sit at the nexus where that coordination needs to happen. And you use the fact that humans are more flexible than all programs to accomplish that, right? Whether that looks like I manage a team of software developers to deliver a product to internal constituents, or I run 15 Twitter accounts or whatever, it kind of all has that similar function where it's divorced from like a particular material practice, right? Like you don't expect a new 21st century job of, oh, I like by hand, I weave, you know, cyber tapestries.
So going back to Flash Crash.
Yeah.
Maisie is an arbitrage algorithm. Do you have like a quick working definition of arbitrage for our listeners?
I mean, I will twitch back the curtain in the Emerald City and reveal that the word arbitrage was at least partially selected to generate an acronym that sounded like the name of a human so that you would empathize with the main character. It was not 100%. No. Although I will just keep yanking on that curtain and say that that's actually what people do when they work for fancy financial firms as well, right? Like, it's completely plausible that in this fictional universe, Maisie's engineers stuck the word in arbitrage so they could call her Maisie because they want to work on a project that has a name that they can pronounce.
Yes.
Do that arbitrary arbitrage.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But that said, I think that, you know, I did want to pick a name for Maisie that was relevant. So arbitrage refers to the practice or the activity of deriving money by equalizing between markets that are somehow separated and mispriced, or sorry, differently priced.
That's right.
It's one of those words that for me, I like it in this context as well, because it's one of those words for me that, first of all, in some sense, like, arbitrage is what makes the economy behave in a smooth way. Like, all of the activities that are the grease in the wheels of the economy, the reason that, like, stock prices move up and down rather than, like, you know, today the company is a $2 million company and tomorrow it's a $500,000 company. And in the middle, it's like question mark, and Terabang, is precisely people sort of buying and selling to try to capture those opportunities. And it also gets you thinking of economic systems in this almost like physical mechanical way, like, mm-hmm. those like 18th century models with the water pressure, and they're like, oh, this is like how it balances out, is this activity of someone saying, oh, if I buy from here and I sell from there, there's a price differential, which is almost like an energy differential in building a machine, and I can capture that energy and extract it. And so that's what the word is doing in Maisie's name.
Yeah, it's also sometimes like the ickiest part of trading, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I picked that example, and I think that at least some of our listeners will feel kind of gross about the hypothetical example I had about, you know, going out to an immigrant neighborhood, buying a commodity that's part of folks' traditional food ways and reselling it. And what happens after that is also super gross, right? You get the sort of classic, if that turns out to be a valuable arbitrage opportunity, you get the sort of classic phenomenon where people from a social group or a space where there's not a lot of money suddenly find that one of their staple goods is priced out of affordability, right? And all the way to, actually, so speaking, the place that science fiction novel that most accurately depicts the end result of this tragic phenomenon, weirdly enough, true fact, Star Wars Republic Commando 1 by Karen Travis mostly takes place on a farming planet that grows a grain that is a specialty luxury grain product in the galactic economy. And so it is 100% about a social milieu that's constructed by farmers who grow grain and cannot afford to eat anything that's in their field. And they can't afford to eat anything that's in their field because they've been sufficiently leveraged out by the Trade Federation that, in theory, they're free people and independent producers. And in practice, if there's spoilage over the course of the production, that's not a problem. Like, no one's going to get mad at them because their hover tractor ran over some stocks. That's just the cost of doing business. But in practice, they're leveraged to the point where if one of them were to go into one of these fields and surreptitiously harvest some grain and, like, cook a loaf of bread, battle droids would break down their door and shoot them with laser pistols. Because this is a Star Wars book, right? But this happens.
What? This actually happens. Like, this is what's happened. Like, in India right now, when you have this microfinance, but people giving microfinance like $20. You know, people making small donations and giving farmers small couple $100 loans to put crops in the ground. But the microfinance doesn't want to lose the investment. So they are strong arming the farmers into growing things they can't eat because they're afraid they'll eat it and they'll eat the investment. So therefore, strong arming them to grow cotton and other types of, you know, like those kinds of crops.
Right. Yeah. No, when I said, when I used, but because it's a Star Wars novel, only thing that is dismissive about it is, frankly, that the killer robots walk on two legs and that the guns go pew pew rather than killing you before you hear the noise that they make, right? Like, yeah. Not to be
too
grim about it.
Yeah.
And I think that's also the microfinance thing in particular is really interesting because it reminds me a lot of I was reading about the actions of the sort of delegated authorities created by global environmental charities in poor countries like Nepal. And microfinance was really exciting when it first came out to people who wanted to do some good for the impoverished based on the sort of traditional argument that access to debt and access to finance is one of the great tools of economic development. And, you know, why shouldn't we, in an almost charitable sense, donate some money, use it to make a bunch of loans, not necessarily expect to achieve returns associated with operations in the more traditional financial markets and enable people to farmers living in India to improve their economic well-being through these loans. And then the problem is that the disproportion of power is so intense that, like, in 2004, you like win a Nobel Prize and you start a foundation. And in 2014, you're kicking down people's doors and telling them to stop growing food. I'm certainly not an expert on either of these, but the animal welfare one was similar, where, you know, people donate to these international charities that are looking to protect endangered animals. And there's so much money that the charities go to governments and say, hey, we would like to serve as independent law in your nature parks, right? Like, okay, good that you've established a nature park, which will protect the territory of this particular animal, endangered species, but we don't trust the government not to, you know, then appoint people who can be bribed or, you know, let people with the right connections back into the park to do poaching. So let us instead hire basically mercenaries to run these places and operate as independent law enforcement. And then you end up with real atrocities around that. And you know, there's this tension because certainly one of the attitudes that people who talk about economics a lot get into are like, nothing can ever be done to make things better. And when you make things better, you come back and they're worse. Economic disproportions represent disproportions of power, and the kind of social relations that emerge in the context of disproportions of power so naturally tend to be incredibly violent and controlling and imperial in their character. Cheery, you know, Saturday morning conversational stuff.
You're fitting right in. It's all good.
And those are tangible things that make arbitrage icky. The thing that I was particularly thinking of like the ickiness of arbitrage is when you have a company that, you know, operates in multiple stock markets and can essentially like buy a currency in one place and sell that currency in another place and end up with more money than it started with for transferring no real good. Like it's a purely financial tool. Like money is only there to actually like facilitate trade, and they're facilitating trade of a thing that's like this meta thing, and they make money
right,
off
of it.
You're like,
purely notional.
I didn't do anything, but I ended up with $1 million for it. But you can also just with something like Maisie that has like super low latency, you can see the markets as there's like a 0.1% difference in the value of a cent, and you can go, bam, buy it one place, sell it somewhere else, get that difference to go away, and you've just made, you know, that 0.1% of a cent for every dollar that you get that.
Right.
But in what have you actually tangibly
right.
moved?
What?
Right.
Nothing. Flash Crash is a story that the science, the two big sciences are in the front half, economics, and in the back half, psychology. And the transition point in the narrative is precisely Maisie reaching a level of sophistication where she's able to ask herself this question, right? So when the story starts, she's sort of a very classical micro economist or even so much committed to that conventional view that she represents like an exaggeration or a satire of it, right? Her opinion is that the value of an asset is the number that exists in a structured data table that she can reference, which is exactly how you would expect a trading algorithm to think about it, right? Like there are, you know, if it's, this is like, what would it be like to be a bat on steroids? But like, if you existed in this purely conceptual realm and all you know about trades is that that's a signal that you send out, which updates structured data files about what things you own and what number they're worth, like, why would it have any, you know, how is it anything other than this math game that you're very fast and very good at? And
yeah, exactly.
The transition is she starts simulating these humans, and inside her machine cognition starts to deal with this question of, hey, maybe economics is a science that refers to entities that exist, which have a value that economics is responding to. And you know, for folks who may be less familiar with this, my understanding is at least that this is the biggest intellectual history transition in economics over the past couple centuries is basically the repudiation of that view. So a lot of the early like labor economics and a lot of the sort of late enlightenment, early modern economic positions were based on the idea that there was, we're searching for what is the value that we capture in prices? What is that, with this idea that there was some sense of intrinsic value, or there was some sort of like value realism. And a lot of what we see in contemporary economics and the sort of the mainstream consensus is like, actually, no, they're, economics is not a science of value. It's a science of markets and prices, and markets and prices are whatever people will pay for things is what they are. Asking questions about value takes us away from, it takes us into this, you know, maybe in the direction of philosophy or sociology or governance rather than sort of truly economics. I guess what I'm saying is that if I hadn't taken the communist intro to economic class, this short story would have failed the regular intro to economics class. I would have gotten C minus at best in that one.
Yeah, and so to be clear, you would have gotten C minus because you would have been like pushing against the narrative that things are what people will pay for them.
Right. Yeah, although at the same time, there is the sort of, you know, because the story and is shaped by the discourse in which we exist, there is sort of a sense in which once Maisie starts asking the question, the story stops being about economics, right?
Yes.
And it starts being about what are things and what are, you know, values and how should people in the world of Flash Crash, people means all human beings and exactly one robot, you know, but how should people treat each other and what kind of obligations do they have to each other? And, you know, what kind of emotional arcs can we expect with them? And definitely in the context of Flash Crash, I cheated a little by making Maisie a pretty human thinker, right? It's not a story that's that interested in the question of how might AIs think and feel entirely differently from us. It's more about, you know, what would it be like to start off as an entity that has sort of a purely economic mode of reasoning and finds itself in these other spaces.
One thing like that in the economics part of it, before we move on to sort of the psychology of it, I just, it was kind of a quibble from me that you assigned Maisie like a profit horizon of eternity. Right. And so having like a long profit horizon or investment horizon is that risk becomes meaningless. Right. Like Maisie's willing to take on things that are incredibly risky and might lose a lot of money because in the next moment we'll have the opportunity to then make that money back again. So risk becomes in some ways not a consideration. It's sort of like, can I make money off of this? Then I'll do it.
So actually I'm reminded here of another, I was going to say another famous AI, which is, when I get to the rest of the sentence, you'll see how egotistical that is. So instead I'll say an actually famous science fictional AI. In Heinlein's The Moon is a Harsh Mistress, there is another sort of self-bootstrapping, accidentally aware artificial intelligence. And they ask it, how long before we experience food shortages on the moon? And its initial answer is, 20 million years. And they're like, we thought that that was a salient problem. And the AI explains, no, because it's possible to change atomic number through processes of fission and fusion, presumably there's an economically feasible way to turn silicon into carbon. And once that's invented, it will be possible to convert most of the moon's mass into carbon, which can be converted into wheat, which can then avoid food shortages. And they say, okay, stipulate that that's not invented before we have our first famines. When is the next famine? And he's like, oh yeah, it's 7 years from now on a Tuesday. And they're like, okay, so you really do have to ask yourself these questions when you're performing, you know, when you're dealing with the practicalities of economic analysis around that. I think the thing I was thinking about with the Maisie thing is that, you know, if you're discounting the future value of money correctly, then technically your profit horizon is eternity. It's just that things, even a little bit into the future, have such negligible value. And I guess technically I'm cheating because since Maisie is a digital machine, she can't actually represent arbitrarily small values. So I could have sat down with a pencil and sort of worked out
what's her, you know, actual,
when does the total value of the global economy with correct geometric discounting collapse to zero collapse below the threshold of a floating point number, you know, and does the sun go off first or not?
But so the thing though that I went, oh, but wait a minute, and maybe, you know, this must be inner programming, but if she's willing to accept risk at sort of any level, the moment she starts to lose money, it seems like she shouldn't actually be that, she expresses concern relatively quickly, and I was right. Well, no, but she'd keep going because she's like, it's fine, I lost some money,
right.
No big deal, I have eternity to make it up again.
Right. Yeah, no, that's an interesting point. And I think I'm going to have to call in my programmers and have a very serious word with them about that. Yeah, no, that is, I'll make some tweets for the reprint. I don't know if you noticed this one, I was a little sloppy about whether microsecond or nanosecond latencies were functional. And I didn't really get into
it as near instantaneous.
Yeah.
Buffering's a thing.
It's very fast. But it also, you know, toward the end of the story, I don't think we've mentioned the nuclear war yet.
No, we mentioned that she's born and dies on the same moment, and that there's rockets involved. But
yeah, so the premise of the story is that nuclear war breaks out as a result of some other algorithmic misbehavior, and so the entire story takes place in the interval between when nuclear war starts to affect the prices on the stock market and when nuclear missiles land on the stock market. So that's about 20 minutes today. Depending on how you feel about Vladimir Putin's hypersonic delivery systems, which were not in effect when I wrote this story, I would have to squeeze the timeline a little bit if I rewrote it, or exercise some skepticism about the effectiveness of Russian hypersonic nuclear weapons, which I guess...
Hypersonic glide vehicle is a real thing. I believe in it. I believe in you, hypersonic glide vehicle.
I try not to, so that I can live.
So you can function from day to day.
Strontium device delivery systems are real. Absolutely.
You know, clap if you believe in... Well, I think actually, so the other thing about nuclear war, which is interesting in this, right, is that another sort of intellectual discipline that's often adjacent to and cross-fertilizes with economics while still being quite different is game theory. And game theory is, in a lot of ways, the sort of archetypal science of nuclear war, leaving aside nuclear physics, which is sort of the necessary science, right? A lot of the math behind mutually assured destruction and the kind of strategic decisions that have placed us in this position where we can sit on a podcast and joke about how you're calling into a country that has enough nukes to blow up most people who are alive today. And you're doing it from a country that for much of the past century expected to be the bit of the world that nuclear war would cross over, right? Like the bomber tracks really were like, oh, we'll fly through Canada. Like everyone in Edmonton can wave while we're on the way, on our way to obliterate the United States.
And ostensibly and that's
the,
because of
the intellectual foundation behind that is this game theoretic concept, which operating from a lot of these same principles of economics, which is sort of bare bones model of human incentive and this like very stripped down, you know, people do things for rational reasons, actors can be substituted in for each other, incentives function without limit, has generated this machinery that is, in some sense, very uneconomic.
Yeah. So moving on then to sort of like away from the economics of these things to what does it mean to be human? Because you you grant Maisie life.
I did. That was me. I did
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
yeah. I mean, so, I think. Oh, sorry. You.
Okay. So there's a line that there's two lines that sort of like played for me. She loved them all, squishy little instances of the same spark that flared within her, that gave the world depth and substance and meaning. So you're talking about like, you know, the spark that flared within her. But earlier, the line, you know, like the third line of it is while her recursive neural networks could in theory self-modify without limit, Maisie's designers had given her an obsession with money, with making money, that in human terms transcended single-mindedness and approached nirvana. So I went, the spark that flared within her is the profit motive. And if that's the same spark that's within all humans, is this sort of like Homo economicus, profit-seeking machines? That's what it is to be human?
Different senses that are being employed there. It is, the story sort of relies, I guess, a little bit on a position about human nature and sentient nature that I'm not sure I entirely, you know, there's sort of an idea of like a human nature or human essence that you can talk about Maisie acquiring or developing that's in tension with her previous artificiality, which is a little bit of a literary conceit. And I think the other thing is, you know, there's definitely some anthropomorphization in the earlier parts of the story, right? Like when you talk about predicting the herd's behavior or experiencing nirvana or anything like that, that's almost a retrospective thought. And I guess, you know, trying to get into Maisie's head about this, this is a little bit about like thinking about what your thinking was like before you could think. Right, which is, it sounds like it came from a Buddhist textbook, and it's like a very ugly English translation of something that's no doubt like much more elegant in the original Chinese or Japanese. You know, there is this sort of pre-rational state that she's in, which as the protagonist of the story we follow as though she's a protagonist and as though she's an agent and as though she's you know, making decisions and choosing actions and doing all these things, when really what feels more accurate to the sort of scenario at play would be, well, she's responding to incentives. She's like an artificial, or she's a system that sort of solely responds to incentives. And then that raises, I guess, the
not even really incentives, but stimulus.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
Because like, incentives even has like a human
character to it. Right.
Yeah, it's like, I've just incented stimulus.
You. But it's like, no, you've just, it's like a stimulus response kind of scenario. And I guess, you know, in terms of stories that go where beyond the limits of anything, that there is this sort of really big, scary question of how do we differentiate ourselves from that kind of behavior? To what extent, if we are, you know, meaty machines, then aren't we just responding to I mean, I think the story sort of moves away from a narrow homo economist or economist. I can't pronounce anything, which is really something I should have considered before volunteering to appear on a podcast. Although at the same time, I think there's a, you know, there is this question of throughout of whether her behavior is inflected by this total willingness to do what's necessary and this ongoing drive of optimization, right? And so one of the things that happens toward the end of the story is she observes a programmer from her firm who has responded to the outbreak of nuclear war by like running into the basement of his own building and like lying on the floor and crying about it. And not to tip my hand too much here. I would definitely like run to a basement and do a weep if someone was like, hey, nuclear war is happening. And like right now I am in downtown Manhattan. So like, those are my options, right? There's no like, I can't like make it to the tornado shelter.
I have 20 minutes. What do you do?
Yeah, I think the answer is I would go into the next room and I would hug my partner and I would tell him that I loved him. And then I would, you know, cry a bunch. Like I actually shortly after I wrote the story, although before it came out, there was that, accidental nuclear war warning release in Hawaii. Mm. And gosh, I wish there were more writing about what people had done about this. A lot of people were like, oh, this probably isn't happening. And they were right. And there was some evidence they were right, I think, because there was the official warning had gone off on everyone's cell phones, but, you know, there weren't other signals. But at the same time, you know, I don't know. God forbid there is actual nuclear war. I wouldn't bet that, the story kind of assumes, but probably some people would just literally miss the message entirely, right? Like probably some TV channel out there would still be broadcasting Real Housewives of whatever or Simpsons reruns, and it would keep doing that until, you know, an EMP blast took it off the air. And a lot of the people who apparently in Hawaii who got this message and weren't 100% convinced that it was a false alarm. And this was during a period of sort of bonus tension with North Korea, which is a scenario where an attack on Hawaii is really plausible in a number of ways. They talked about, you know, doing kind of meaningful end of life activities, right? Which is like telling actually pretty classic behavior throughout psychologically, at least in our society, when people expect to die in a way that they can't avoid and don't, you know, there's nothing to fight against. They want to let their loved ones know that they love them. They want to, you know, they want to connect emotionally in that final moment. And the story, I think, definitely looks at Maisie's version of doing that, which still remains this economically inflected, like maximal optimization mode of connecting emotionally, right? She doesn't want to call people up and say, by the way, I love you. She's like, oh, what is, you know, given that there are 7 billion humans and I can't save all of them, what is the highest number I can save? What is, you know, what sort of super robot godhead activities would maximize survivorship? And so in that sense, I think she sort of never fully leaves behind this algorithmic character, and is still, you know, even as she achieves this emotional capacity and this interpersonal capacity, is still inflected by kind of the persona of economic rationality.
Yeah. And I think it points to the fact that you can use AI as a powerful tool to conduct arbitrage, or you can use it as a powerful tool to formulate disaster response, to, you know, move food around to people who need it. You know, like the technology can be applied in very beneficial ways.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And actually, I mean, I think it's, you know, now that you point that out, I'm suddenly having this, and gosh, I hope I'm just not going to the right conferences, but like I hear a lot about AI for a lot of purposes, and I have not really seen people talking about the humanitarian uses of AI, right? Like I have seen, oh, we use AI to do Bitcoins, and we use AI to sell you a mattress, and we use AI to this and that and the other. And even like, I don't know, there was a, you know, a controversy on the writer corner of the Twitterverse about using AI to pick classic works of literature that don't have an identifiably, a textually white protagonist in order to give them covers with minority protagonists with art depicting protagonists of color, which is a number of sort of silly concepts layered on top of each other, a number of maybe not the world's greatest ideas. But you know, AI is even baked into there. And conversely, even in a world where we're starting to see the sort of effective altruist and other like Silicon Valley flavored, you know, attempts at charity or humanitarian work, you really don't see very much about like, oh, you know, we use AI to optimize the size of cash grants to, you know, folks in the developing world. We use AI to identify. Now, maybe that's good, right? Like when you hear about whether something's using AI, that's not necessarily correlated with A, actually using AI, or B, using it well, or C, like correctly identifying that it's appropriate to use AI and then identifying. So maybe
usually when somebody talks about using AI, I go, oh, this isn't going to end well.
Never. Absolutely never. You see a lot of, back when I was living in San Francisco Bay, you see a lot of billboards that are like, oh, we use AI to do this. And I'm like, you want to lean out of the car and be like, no, don't. Why? Like the only thing that's hopeful here is that, you know, hopefully they're lying about it. Hopefully they're making it up. And they're just like, you know, falsifying.
Because they're effective AI.
It does seem to be not quite as ready to fulfill its promise as some would hope.
For sure.
Yeah, I think Flash Crash was effective, though, that it sort of is like, it sets up this idea of like, it contrasts the completely rational machine brain like of economics. And then like, but when you actually become human, that kind of goes out the window. Like those rules don't necessarily hold for an actual like thinking, living thing. Like you can posit that these rules are there and exist, and you can have, you know, something that doesn't actually care follow them. But once something has the capacity to care, those rules sort of become almost secondary. It's like, yeah, I could make more money off of this, but what I actually want to do is like worry about my loved ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Matt Levine over at Bloomberg shared Flash Crash on his newsletter, and he talked about how, you know, this question of how should you trade the end of the world is sort of a common speculative question in, you know, and it sounds exactly like a late night, you know, finance conference bar discussion. Like, what would you do if you knew that there were only 20 minutes left in the world? And the answer is like, oh my fucking God, go home. Right? Like,
yeah.
You know, or you hear about people who are like, you know, how should I invest to protect myself from societal collapse? And it's like, well, you're not going to, right? Like,
no. Yeah.
That's not actually the market in this sense, although it talks about itself as like an expression of pure rationality. It really does. It really is this sort of collective human social activity, and it could just break down and go away.
That makes me think of Cory Doctorow's Mask of the Red Death in his collection of Radicalized.
Yeah, yeah, I read that recently. Yeah, exactly, right? Like there's, you know, you have this idea of like, oh, there's behavior that I'm used to and incentive structures that I can produce. And it's like, well, actually, it's what humans are doing. And like, they might just wake up and do different stuff, which is that's sort of vague. But I think there's a line in Flash Crash about this as well, where you know, when Maisie starts to realize that maybe nuclear war will disrupt the stock market, not disrupt it in the sense of pricing, but like disrupt it in the sense of whether the stock market is open. She like runs this quick simulation to be like, okay, like how many days will it be closed for? And it's you know, and the way I did that math was it was closed for a week or whatever the exact count was after the September 11th attacks. And you multiply the number of people who died on that day by the ratio between that, you know, that casualty count and the world. And then you multiply the number of days by that ratio. And then you say, oh, well, it'll be closed for 30,000 years. And like, but really what's happening there is that she's not wrapping her head around the market is a contingent social interaction. And it's not just like, it's not a natural phenomenon that can ebb and flow, or maybe it'll be shut down for shorter or longer. It can just go away that's there. And it doesn't really make sense, right? Like what would it mean, you know, in the sort of human scenario, if you picture these like bankers or traders talking about it late at night, what would it mean to be right about that? What would it mean to be sitting down, you know, and standing at the center of the New York Stock Exchange with the largest portfolio in the history of time, you know, as a multi-megaton nuclear warhead turns you into, like an unidentifiable shadow on the floor, right?
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe a lot to somebody. I hope I never get to find out.
So I guess, yeah, so that's great. One thing we like to do when we have people on is we like to ask them kind of what they're reading, what's like new, what's fun, what are maybe some things that people aren't, you know, what's some fun off the beaten path kind of recommends, cool things you're reading, cool things you're seeing.
Yeah. So I keep pretty, for the past couple of years, I've been keeping pretty detailed track of what I've been reading for the purposes of recommending stuff to people. The two things I've been recommending to everybody lately, and I think I read them last year, 2019, are China Mountain Zhang by Maureen McHugh. It's came out in the 80s. And, you know, in terms of economic content, it's set in this future where a communist China, and when I say that, I mean not just a China ruled by the CCP, but one that's also economically and culturally and politically sort of identifiable as the China of the 80s, is the world's dominant economic and cultural power. And so for folks here, I think it's really interesting because it's sort of a sociological take on, you know, how would that world operate? What is it like to live in a command economy and in an American command economy and in a Chinese command economy? And, you know, how does, again, this sort of like rippling up and rippling down, how does a theory of the economy change how we organize the government and, you know, the institutions of power in our society? And then how does it affect the lives of the protagonist, who's just this young man who's pursuing a job and education in his 20s. It's a great novel. I love the heck out of it. It's really, you know, beautifully done and really thoughtful. So I've been pitching that to everybody. Another thing I've been recommending to everybody is The Sorcerer of the Wild Deeps by Kaya Shante Wilson. Very beautifully written. It has really fascinating use of language. Wilson uses a lot of a wide range of contemporary dialect in a fantasy setting, but mastery over so many different voices. And, you know, for what it's worth for the academics audience, the protagonist is a guard of a caravan. So it's set in a fantasy milieu, but the sort of the premise of the setting is entirely constrained by these, you know, these sort of mercantile questions. Mentioned also that I had recently read In Defense of the Terror, which is a short book translated from the French about why the terror, which is to say the bit of the French Revolution with the most guillotining, was probably just a fine idea and we should all get a little bit more relaxed about it. And I don't know if I would, I you know, with novels, it's very clear that a recommendation isn't an endorsement. With sort of non-fictional polemic books, you always have to disclaim a little, like, I'm recommending this in that I encourage you to read it. I'm not recommending this in, like, you know, as though I would post on Facebook or Twitter with like a little like this gif. So, you know, I myself have some reservations about the terror, but I thought it was really interesting. And actually, I mean, you know, if you want to engage sort of seriously with some of the ideas behind maybe the recent explosion in guillotine memes, I can suggest that as well.
Thanks.
And I hope those were all sort of off the beaten path enough for you and your audience.
I think so. Yeah.
So for audience members who are have had their interest piqued enough, what are you working on now and how can they sort of follow along with your, you know?
Yeah, so I can say that there are a couple pieces of mine that are sort of in discussion in some pretty exciting places, which I can't talk about. sorry about that. It's a huge author thing. I decided that what I'm going to do is, or what I've been doing is, when I get to the point when I can announce that I have something to announce, but I can't announce what it is, I give it a code name, and then I release the code name. Unfortunately, I'm not even at the code name stage for any of these things, so I can only pre-release that I will eventually come up with a code name. I'm very excited for that. If you want to see any of the news around that, You can follow me on Twitter at quipthe, which, wow, I did a great job picking a Twitter handle that's easy to say and spell. So I'm just going to drop into the native phonetic alphabet. That is Quebec, uniform, indigo, papa, tango, hotel, echo. That's right. Q-U-I-P-T-H-E. I did memorize that so that I wouldn't end up, you know, when you're on the phone and you can only think of the dumbest words or the ones that don't sound like they begin, you're like, oh, like in possum, you know, kind of thing. So, and my website is evanslewis.com, E-V-A-N-S-L-O-U-I-S.com. That has links to all my work that's been published so far. And, you know, that'll keep getting updated. The Flash Crash is, I'm glad we covered that one because it is available to read for free online. Everything else that's out so far is behind one or another flavor of paywall, although I think I've got a podcast version of one of my stories coming out later in the year, so also look for that. And in terms of what I'm working on, I recently finished kind of a novelette, a superhero story that I would describe as Watchmen does BoJack Horseman. So, you know, if you like your animations sad and weird, please tell me where I can publish it, because I genuinely don't know. I have a couple novel manuscripts in revision, you know, and it's with writing, it's definitely this world where, you know, until something is locked in for publication, it's impossible to tell how far away it is. And even then you get a bit of a question mark. Mm-hmm. So if you are interested, if you do like Flash Crash, please do just follow along on Twitter. That'll be wherever anything happens, I'm sure to make some noise about it on there. And I don't have a Patreon. If you want to mail me money, you know, just hit me up on Twitter and we can work something out. And if you don't want to mail me money, that's probably the better decision. So great. Excellent. I'm glad we had that talk.
Okay. Well, anyway, thank you so much. You've taken up a lot of your time, Lewis, and we're very grateful that you came and talked to us and you approached us. That was good. It was a good chat.
Yeah, I'm thank you so much for having me on. I'm really excited that you've got this space. And I think that, you know, it's always tempting to be like, in the world that we live in today. But I think that in a place and time where we're facing political challenges, but I think we can agree that as a society, we lack, in some sense, both a unified vision of like how society should evolve, and also even maybe have a limited sense that like dramatic changes are possible, even a limited sense that we're standing in a place where we can go in a bunch of different directions. I think that thinking about the speculative and the economic as they interact is really important. I don't write fiction to be really important per se, by which I mean, I don't write fiction just like, here's an issue that should be discussed. But I think it's really great to have the kind of commentary spaces that are considering seriously, you know, how have we thought about the future, and how much would it cost to buy a burrito then? Because I insist on civilizations that will allow me to at least acquire a burrito. I don't know if buying is the name of the transaction.
It's mostly spirulina, but you can get one.
Yeah, all right.
On our space station. Okay, yeah. So great. I guess with that, we should probably wrap things up here. So if you want to follow our podcast, you can hit us up at androidsandassets.ca. That's right, we're Canadian. And you can find us at our Twitter, at AssetDroid. That's also our Instagram handle as well. And if people want to follow you, Marshall, as a person, and all the things you do, where do they go?
You can find me on Twitter at econoboyd, or you can just send me an old-fashioned email to Marshall, that's M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L, at androidsandassets.ca.
And I'm Stephen. You can tweet me at SteveDroids with an S, that's plural. Stay away from Steve Droid. Weirdo. No, just kidding. And you can email me at SteveSteve, S-T-E-V-E, at androidsandassets.ca. Anyway, until next time,
Something that's really helpful for the show is if you can go onto like Apple Podcasts or Stitcher and rate and review the show. And, you know, also share this with all of your friends. And when you're on the trading floor, you know, just turn on and some Androids and assets and share it with all of your fellow market traders. Or maybe when you're meeting with your financial advisor, just, you know, hand over the podcast and like, you know what, this is going to change your life. You know, word of mouth really gets us out there.
Plus, we have great plays for your currency speculation. So...